This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Joshua Johnson is host of the daily show 1A that's produced out of WAMU in Washington, D.C. and distributed by NPR. He was born and raised across the state in West Palm Beach and became interested in journalism as a kid. He was inspired by African-American journalists like Ed Bradley, Bernard Shaw, and Dwight Lauderdale. He graduated from the University of Miami and got his start in public radio there, working for a collaborative project between WLRN and the Miami Herald from 2004 to 2010. After a stint as morning newscaster at KQED out in San Francisco, he hosted the radio series Truth Be Told, which dealt with issues of race in America. Its four episodes were broadcast nationally. He also taught courses in podcasting at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. In September of 2016, he guest-hosted the Diane Rehm Show for 2 days, and then, in November, she announced he would be taking over her time slot, and 1A premiered at the beginning of 2017. We've been carrying it here on WGCU ever since. Last week, he came to town to talk with John Davis and me at an event here at the station, and we were able to record it. The conversation was so good, we wanted to share it with all our listeners, so let's hear that now.
Thanks very much. Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. I'll do my little TV trick. They teach you in television you're supposed to sit on the end of the... There we go.
Sit on the back of your suit.
This is what happens when you start showing up on NBC. You think you're Lester Holt, so I'm just going to try to do it.
So I want to thank Rick for the kind words of introduction. It's always good to hear from Rick about all the stuff that we do and who we are and be reminded of all of that. But it's also a really huge honor to be able to talk with a person that I listen to every single day. I'm not stalking you.
You and 4 million other people, so
yeah.
It's all right. It's nice to be needed.
Yeah, but I mean, I love listening to you every single day, so it's just great to be able to sit here on a stage and talk with you about a little bit about, you know, what you do, where you come from, and kind of the current state of things.
Sure.
And it's great for you to get to talk to John Davis, because you guys both do morning show. You did the morning show. He's our guy.
Oh, that's right.
I did. I was the morning newscaster at KQED for 5.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, as Rick had mentioned, you kind of gotten your start in Florida. I was hoping you could take us back to that time a little bit, because I kind of get the impression that the partnerships that you were building with the Miami Herald and the WLRN, our listeners continue to benefit from now, because those collaborations continue, and they, of course, share content with us.
Yeah, it was a great partnership that, you know, John Labonia, who's the general manager at WLRN and still is general manager, kind of cooked up with the team over there when Alberto Abargwin was the publisher, to figure out how to provide a regional news service for South Florida, because the Miami Herald at the time had a gigantic news team. It's still a large team, but nowhere near what it was when I joined back in 2004. So when I joined in March of 2004, the program or the service had just gotten off the ground by like 6 months. So I was very early on. I wasn't on the ground floor, but I was near the ground floor. And then a few months into my time there, I was promoted to afternoon anchor. So I was doing the news during All Things Considered and cranking out four-minute newscasts at 4, 4:30, 5, 5:30, 6:30, and 7, and like really just cranking them out. And did that for 2 years, kind of burned out on doing the news all the time, and went to full-time reporting for 2 years, and then found a split between anchoring and reporting. A large part of what we did at the Herald, because at the time I worked for the Miami Herald on WLRN, that's how the partnership worked, was training Herald writers to do radio work. And at first it was just, you know, we bring you in a studio and we do kind of like, if anyone listens to The Daily from the New York Times, very similar, where we just tell us about your story. And we would pull sound bites from that, or we would do, you know, small segments from that. Eventually, some of the reporters who showed an affinity for radio, we would train them to use audio recorders. Not all the reporters, but quite a few of the writers would go out with recorders if we knew what story they were going to cover. We would ask them, hey, could you get a little sound for us? And so we would teach them how to do that. A few of the people who I helped train ended up working in broadcasting. Nyla Boodoo was a business reporter at the Miami Herald, started a Friday Business Report on WLRN, and then got hired to host on WBEZ Chicago. She's now working at Illinois Public Media, which is in Urbana-Champaign, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Bridget Carey was a business reporter. She's now the senior editor for technology at CNET in New York because she found an affinity for doing this work. So it was kind of teaching people how to write for the ear instead of to write for the eye. It was teaching photographers how to view gathering sound differently than taking pictures. It took a while, but one of the things we realized is when you're a photographer, you have to shut everything out to try to get this picture. And it's the difference between being a hunter and a gatherer, right? When you're a photographer, you're a hunter. You're looking for that shot, and you, I mean, it's called a shot, for goodness sake. When you work in public radio, you have to be a gatherer. You show up at a story, and you don't know where the good stuff's going to come from. So you have to be open to all of it. And part of the work that we did, which is so valuable in a multimedia news environment now, is teaching people how to activate different parts of their brain and their heart for different kinds of creative tasks and understanding what makes them different. So if someone runs into trouble, like, I just can't find the right soundbites, or I just don't know how to write this thing, it made it easier for me in the future to be able to say, oh, here's what's wrong. You might be thinking of it this way. You might be conceiving of it in that way. And it facilitates doing multimedia work. A lot of newsrooms were just like, here's a camera, here's an audio recorder, here's a laptop, we're going to send you to training, and you have to file everything all the time. Go. As opposed to being able to say, here is the way you approach this kind of work, here's the way you approach that kind of work, so that you feel like you have, if not expertise, but facility with all kinds of different multimedia work.
I think it's interesting that you talk about those kinds of collaborations between newspapers and the radio, and that was more of a training situation. We do a lot of that here with Gulf Coast Live. If we have a reporter that we see in the area that's done a great story, we'll bring them in and do a reporter debrief is what we call it. So, and it's a way to put a little bit more legs on a good piece of journalism. So we really love being able to do that. So, and it's funny because some are really great at talking on the radio. Some of them, it takes some coaxing.
Takes a little warming up, yeah.
To get more than three words, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do.
But
I
when
do
we
indeed.
Were talking earlier, you made an analogy that I really loved, and I'd really like you to share it with everybody here today. You were talking about heat and light. As a descriptor for journalism, the things that tell a good story, I want you to tell me a little bit about how emotion and facts play together for your show's style.
Yeah, I mean, 1A, we try to make it... First of all, is there anyone here... I assume that everyone here has heard 1A at least once. Is there anyone... And be honest, is there anyone here who has no idea who I am or what the show is? Somebody just brought you along. Okay, thank you for being honest. Anybody else? You're like, why? Thank you. You're like, why are these people clapping for this fool with a mohawk? You have no idea why I matter. Thank you for your honesty. We're a program that tries to act as a kind of a national mirror, to kind of hold an image up to the country and show us what we are in a different way so we can talk more honestly about some of the issues that the country faces. We cover a little bit of everything, politics and pop culture and local issues and national and international. Every Friday we do a news roundup where we do an hour summarizing the biggest national stories of the week, often a lot of politics, and another hour where we summarize the big international stories of the week. We have all kinds of other features that we do. Once a month we do a 1A movie club where we'll all go see a new movie in the theaters and then we'll review it together. Sometimes we'll be able to get some people from the creative team. This week we had the team from Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the new animated film that came out, which is so good. And we try to make it very audience-driven. Usually before we do a show, the day before we'll say, tomorrow we're talking about X. And we'll do a call out to try to get people to share their stories about it. So we'll say, how has this affected you firsthand? Leave us a voicemail. So instead of doing live calls, we'll do voicemails. And the audience in that way helps us kind of build the show. They co-author the show. It happens often where we'll start going through voicemails and we'll say, we got a lot of voicemails like this. And it will change the structure of the show before it airs. So that's 1A. For those three of you who are new to the show... I'm so glad to meet the three of you because you're the ones that we really need to reach. I'm happy for all the fans, but really, you're the reason I showed up here tonight. You, and you. Here's my analogy about the kind of energy we want to bring to the show. Science teaches us that everything that creates light creates at least a little bit of heat, but not everything that creates heat creates light. I think journalism is the same way. Because you have a lot of journalism out there that's very emotional and it's very sensational and it's very heated, but it doesn't illuminate. On the other hand, you have a lot of content, especially in public media, that's very thoughtful and erudite and intellectual and very focused on the geopolitical and sociological ramifications of the situation, that it's boring. And it's so busy being bright that it's cold and it's bloodless. And I think both of those are bad. What we try to be on 1A is more light than heat, but not all light and no heat. Does that make sense? So if there's an issue that's got people fired up, we obviously don't want people screaming at one another, but the emotion you bring to that issue is part of the story. And if I say, well, you can talk to us, but first you have to calm all the way down, I kind of denature what makes it your story. You might have a perfectly legitimate reason for being furious over something in your community or something that's going on in the country or in the world. And for me to say, well, we'd love to hear your story, but calm down, it's bad journalism, in my view. Your emotion should have a space to be vented. And once we allow you to speak, then we can have the illuminating conversation. And it also makes it better conversations and really kind of makes it easier. Because we'll book subject matter experts. But we usually start with someone on the ground who's directly affected, a small business owner, a mother with children, you know, a community leader, and say, what's the view from where you are? So that no matter what these big policy issues are we're talking about, we're always clear that this is not theoretical to the people for whom this is a living issue. There are actual people for whom something is at stake in this story. And now that we're clear that this is a human story, now let's talk policy. And it changes the way that we have conversation because it prevents people from being so cruel to one another. It's easy to be mean to someone who disagrees with you when it's about that person with whom you disagree. But by starting the show with a personal story, it can't be about the person with whom you disagree. Because we just met this person for whom something is at stake. So it's about them. It's not about the Democrats and the Republicans arguing over a bill. It's about this community that is depending on their leaders to get this right. And now we can talk about policy, and it humanizes it in a way that has never, ever failed us. It makes for a good blend between getting into the weeds, which we do. We don't avoid the details, but it allows us to get into the weeds in the right order after we've allowed ourselves to tell a good story and paint a good picture and make it really compelling so we gotcha for the hour. Like, don't turn away from this hour, because remember, we introduced you to these people, and this is really important to them. So now that we've made it important to you, now let's talk policy. That's how that works for us.
It's almost like the way Frank Lloyd Wright viewed architecture is the way that you enter into a building will influence how you experience the entire building. So entering into a conversation through a person's individual human story can color and add to every other experience while discussing that topic because it's in there.
Yeah.
It's,
well, and beginnings matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's that, you know, everyone here seen Star Wars? Think about how Star Wars begins, right? When people think about the beginning of Star Wars, what do they usually think of? I mean, I'm talking about the first Star Wars. Right. Bam, ba-da-bam, ba-da-bam. And that crawl, you know, tan, tan, ta-da-da-da, as it's going off in the distance. But that's not actually the beginning of Star Wars. The beginning of Star Wars is a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. But nobody thinks of that. They think of bum, ba-da-bum, ba-da-bum, that score by John Williams, because that's the hook. That's the beginning, because that's the part that makes you sit up. I bet you don't even remember the beginning of that crawl. Episode 4, A New Hope. What's the first sentence? Don't Google it. I'll wait.
Totally not a Star Wars person.
It is a period of civil war. So the crawl tells you the whole beginning of the story. Episode 7, the J.J. Abrams one that began the new trilogy, begins, Luke Skywalker has disappeared. Nobody remembers. Nobody was looking for the text of the crawl. They were like, oh boy, here it comes. And they weren't, and when you saw a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away in episode 7, you could feel people in the theater go, bum, bada bum. And we have to, even in public media, we have to respect the way that we receive story. That's intrinsic. Like, once we got you, then we can go into smart stuff. Doesn't mean we have to dumb it down. It just means we can't go for your head so much that we forget about your heart. We got to tell a story that appeals to both. And that's where I totally understand where Frank Lloyd Wright is coming from, in that the beginnings are important, and having an eloquent and impactful and compelling beginning is the key to doing great journalism. Not just, today we're going to tell you about this policy issue. That may be good news gathering, but it's bad storytelling. And journalism is both. And on 1A, we try to be good news gatherers and great storytellers. And when we do the show right, that's usually what it hinges on.
Interesting. I kind of wanted to take things a little personal, and I hope that's okay. But whenever you were on our live broadcast earlier this afternoon of Three Song Stories, you know, you had talked about, you know, wondering, I think, with your identity, you know, both as a black man and as a gay man, if there was going to be a place for you in the sort of platform that you have now with 1A. And it got me thinking about my own beginnings in journalism at a time where, you know, if you were gay and you were a journalist, the rule of thumb was generally you shouldn't really participate in like a gay pride sort of event.
Right.
Whereas now they're very commonplace. They're considered almost family-friendly events, and it's not even an issue. And I was really surprised when 1A started hearing some early episodes where you openly acknowledged your sexuality. And coming from where I had come from, where that was something that we were just kind of like, well, you just don't go there because this is still sort of controversial. You know, this was a time when, you know, legalized gay marriage was still more than a decade away. And of course, a lot's changed in that time. But I'm curious about what led you to make the decision to not be out in your life, but be out on that show.
Well, I came out in South Florida. Like, I started public radio in Fort Lauderdale. So I was kind of among family. Yeah. And that wasn't really a problem. But I made a decision really early on in my career about how I wanted to deal with that. And for me, and I want to be clear, this is my decision. I would not tell someone else how to pursue their life. I decided I could not build a career telling the truth about everyone else's life and lying about my own. I can't do it. I know there are some people who needed to remain very quiet and very closeted because of where they live or their circumstances, but again, I was in Fort La-Di-Da, and so I was going to be fine. And so I figured I either need to not be gay, or I need to be able to own every aspect of my life so that if someone comes to me and says, are you? I can go, yep, next question. And just kind of knock them out of the way and go on with my life. I don't talk about my personal life on the show unless it's germane, because I don't want the show to be like about me. But I know the kind of vulnerability it can take to tell your story to 600,000 people at one time. And so if the show is a safe space for me to be who I am, it becomes a safer space for you to be who you are. Because you can't give what you don't have. So I have to be able to have the kind of comfort in myself enough to say, whoever you are is fine with me. Whatever you bring to the table, that's cool. Just be nice to our other guests and be honest with me and answer my questions as directly as you can, and we're cool, and we'll be square. It wasn't an instantaneous process, but the deeper I got into learning interviewing and learning journalism, the more I saw the parallel, the more I saw the benefit of treating people the way that I wanted to be treated. I mean, I never dealt with any like outright homophobia in my career, thank goodness. I mean, I went from Fort Lauderdale to San Francisco, so to Washington. So like, there's been an angel on my shoulder who's also been my travel agent, clearly, and my career counselor all the way. But being able to kind of show people the sort of compassion and empathy and welcome that I wanted and that sometimes I did not get from other gay people. That changed me as an interviewer. And it kind of put me on a path to be able to do the work that I'm doing now.
So, okay, you worked in San Francisco as the morning news guy, and you were at KQED, and then you hosted a radio series called Truth Be Told, which dealt with issues of race in America. When was that? How long ago was that?
That was 2016, early 2016, early mid 2016, yeah.
Well, it's been almost 2.5 years ago, I guess, right?
2.5, almost 3 years, yeah.
Almost 3 years. So, you know, that's almost like, in this political age, that's like 27 dog years, right?
Right.
So, I guess I'm wondering.
Like, I think like, you know, Zachary Taylor was president back then or something. It was a long time ago.
I know it feels that way. It does.
Yeah.
But I'm asking, I'm wondering, how do you think that the conversation on race has progressed or regressed since just 3 years ago?
I think it's better now.
Is it still a hard thing to talk about, though, on the show?
Yes. It's always hard. I mean, we have a team that's down for it. We have a very diverse team, you know, people of every background. Our team is majority female. We have a multi-generational team. We have people in their late teens and 20s and 30s and up. You know, they're down for talking about issues of identity. They lean right into it. So the production staff is all for it.
But what about the audience? Does the audience have a tough time with things? Is that when you get some of your most vehement responses? And I've heard you talk a little bit every once in a while about some of these emails that you'll get of people that really want to tell you what's what.
Yeah, or they just don't like that 1A is becoming such a black show.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Like, I get that, and I get that if that's all we talk about, we will turn even people of color away who may want to hear about other things. So part of the work that I have to do, that Rupert, our executive producer, has to do, that the senior producers have to do, is kind of figure out the balance of the way that we want to talk about these issues, make sure that we're mixing it up, because identity is something we're comfortable about talking about, and so it's easy for us to get into a groove, into a rut, because it's safe. For us, it's safe territory. So I get that. Like, we should be mixing it up for the kind of program that we are. Doesn't mean there shouldn't be spaces that deal squarely with identity. 1A is not that space, but we have the facility to deal with it whenever we want. And I think my responsibility and our responsibility is to do it in a way that is as palatable as possible, that is as compassionate as possible, without flinching when people say, oh my God, this makes me uncomfortable. Because those people for whom it is uncomfortable are also people we have a responsibility to serve. And it's in our mission. The stated mission of NPR is to work in partnership with member stations to create a more informed public, one that is challenged and invigorated by a deeper understanding and appreciation of events, ideas, and cultures. That is the stated mission of NPR. Nothing about NPR's mission includes comfort, nor does it include affinity. It's not my job to make you comfortable. It's my job to challenge you, but also to invigorate you. So you come away from the conversation like, that was worth it. Like, that was worth it. It should feel like a jog, not like a slog, by the time the show is over. So we got to find a way in for everybody, not just for the people. And we argue about this because, you know, as a person of color, you get tired of justifying your existence to white folks and explaining, please, nice white person, this is a very important story. Please help me. I am but a humble black man with a story to tell. That gets old after a while. And I get it. You get tired of having to say, can I please tell you my story? And I get it. It gets tiresome for LGBT people to try to please, nice straight person, I am but a humble homo with a story to tell. That gets old. Or for women to try to tell men, please, nice Mr. Man, I am but a poor female with a story to tell. I get it. Like, if you are a marginalized community, you're tired of being told to wait your turn. I totally get it. The flip side is the people who are asking you to wait your turn are exactly where the change can be made. Like, they're where the gold is to be mined. Some won't ever listen. But those who will, in NPR, we have a responsibility to try to get you to show up. And sometimes it just takes building a little bridge over to where you are. So with issues of race, it's okay for us to say, here's why this is important. and to set it up at the top of the show, and then we dive in. And then if you're not down for it, okay, that's fine. But we have a responsibility to extend our hand to you at least and let you know that it's not your job to walk in knowing that this is good for you. It is not your... John Dewey once said the media's job is to interest the public in the public interest. It's not your job to be interested. It's our job to be interesting. We have to go get you and convince you to give us the most irreducibly valuable asset you will ever have, which is your time. And your time matters. And if race matters, if gender matters, if sexuality matters, if religion, if politics, if culture, if civility matter, then why the hell wouldn't we bend our backs to try to do a better job of telling that story? It's too important. And it's too late in the day for us to say, well, if you don't want to hear it, we just don't need to talk to you. We're past that, at least on 1A. We think it's too important to try to make sure that everybody's in the room. So we try to do a little extra effort. Now, once you're in, you get the whole story. You get to say whatever's on your mind. And there's a point at which, okay, you down for the conversation? We're going to do this, and we're not going to flinch. But on the way in, sometimes it's okay to say, you know, hey, we know this is hard. That's why we're doing it. We know you don't have anyone in your circle of friends to talk to about this. That's why we're doing it, so you can talk to us about it. That's actually our function as a show. So it's hard, but it also feeds into exactly what the show is supposed to be.
I gotta totally give you a personal little bit of thanks too, because you said a thing a while back that resonated with me and has stayed with me since then. And it was when you were interviewing Terry Gross in front of the Public Radio News Directors Conference. And you said a thing. I was recording it, thank goodness. I started recording a few minutes in, but I listen to it every once in a while. You were talking about people who come at you angry. And the people who come at you angry, you said, I always remember that they're actually really hurting. And that really stuck with me. And I think that can be instructive for every human being to have you walk us through that real quick, because I just loved it, and it really stayed with me every time I get angry emails from people, or I get, you know.
Yeah.
I get a few.
Yeah.
Just one or two.
And, you know, and it happens. It's kind of par for the course. And, you know, if you're doing something worthwhile, you're going to tick somebody off sooner or later. But I'll give you an example of when it came up. We had the show on the road in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we were doing an hour, or at least two segments of our three-segment show about police corruption in Baltimore and the efforts to reform. And one of the guests was a former Baltimore police officer, also former active duty soldier, who now works in law enforcement reform. He was a remote guest. So I'm in Michigan, he's in Phoenix, I think, or Tucson. And so I start in with his first question anyway. I said, so tell us, you know, give us an example of something you encountered as an officer in Baltimore PD that is an example of the kind of, you know, of corruption that you encounter. Well, first of all, let me just say that the entire system of law enforcement needs to be reformed, because the prison industrial complex benefits off the backs of black men by keeping us in a state of permanent slavery, and the prison industrial complex benefits from breaking African Americans, and it's high time that Americans, and I'm like, hey, I just asked for a story, okay? Please, come down off the soapbox. I'll let you get back up, but not right now. And every time I asked him a question, he went right back to his talking points. And I could not wrangle this guy. I'm like, when is this hour over? Can we? If I had a time machine, I would use it once to get this show over with. We go to break, and I'm like, geez, how am I going to handle this guy? We come back from break. I ask him another question, because I had to ask him another question, because he was a guest. And so.
So annoying.
I don't know. People who show up on the radio and think they're entitled to speak.
Airtime.
And I ask him a question, and as I ask him a question, just ever so slightly, I almost missed it, I heard his voice waver. I was like, oh. And when he stopped, I said, I hope I'm not off base by bringing this up, but the way you describe your experience being a Baltimore police officer, you sound like the experience left you traumatized. Do you carry trauma from being a police officer. And he said, I put people behind bars who are better people than I am. And then it made sense. See, the way people treat you is not about you. It's about them. And in that moment, it reminded me that I was judging him for his anger instead of trying to receive him and see what was really there. This man was traumatized by being a law enforcement officer. Try to wrap your head and your heart around that for a minute. You sign up to wear a gun and a badge to try to walk the beat and keep the streets safe, and you find yourself part of this system that is designed to let people who took the same oath you took get away with damnable things. And there's nothing you can do. And because you wear the same badge and the same uniform as them, you're just as bad as they are. Only you're not, but you are, because you're part of it. You don't want to be, but you are. And now you're done with it, and you don't know what the hell to do with your emotions. That's what I walked into. And it just reminded me to try to understand people's anger. Now, granted, there are some people who are just angry because they like anger and because they like to fight it out verbally and they just like to argue. Those people are out there, and I have no tolerance for them. I will slap them live on the air and make sure that they behave and act in a civil manner. And I had to do it. I've had to do it more than once. But it also kind of reminded me that when someone is fired up enough about an issue to break the rules of social engagement and raise their voice at you and point at you and tell you what they think, it's because they're afraid to let you in close. If I yell at you, you won't come close to me. And if I don't let you come close to me, you can't see how broken I am by what I went through, by what they did to me, by what they took from me, by what they made me do to someone else. In the name of the law, in the name of the company, in the name of God, in the name of our government, you won't have to see what I did. You don't have to see me in all of my brokenness and pain and deep, deep shame. So I'll just be mad. I'll be mad because then you will leave me alone and we will part company and you will never have to think of me again and I will never let you see behind the 20-ton shield that is protecting all of the broken pieces of my heart. That's why he's mad. And the best moments in an interview with someone who is just, who's just volcanic, are the ones where I'm able to kind of survive the lava flow long enough to let them burn that out. And then once they've burned it out, I can acknowledge it. And then that gives them permission to put the shield down. That's part of why civil conversation is hard, because it requires you to accept that wave of vitriol and know that it's not about you. It's about them. But it feels like it's about you because you're wearing it. But it's not. It's coming from an honest place that may be reparable if only it could just drain, if it could just have somewhere to go. Now, it's not your job to listen to that. So if you were in that situation and you can't endure it, it's okay to say, oh, new dealer, I'm out. I can't do this. But for us, for our program, we're built for that. And the moments when we've been able to just validate somebody who was hurting and recognize the anger as pain, it's kind of incalculable what a difference it makes to just recognize that some people have to carry that 20-ton shield. And they're tired of carrying it, but they are scared as hell to put it down.
This is like a therapy session. I'm realizing.
Goosebumps. I totally had goosebumps
like
and I cried a little.
I've been covertly angry host, and I'm saying so many things differently.
You know?
What you...
Now who... Thank you. Before we continue... can we just pass the plate right quick? Can we? No. Oh, no.
For public media? Yeah, well,
you
sure.
can make a contribution to WGCU by calling 1-800. How many of you are members of WGCU? How many of you are sustaining members of WGCU monthly? Thank you so much. Before we continue, thank you for your support of this station. It was members like you who supported Diane Rehm for years and for decades, who had no idea that one day you would pave the way for someone like me to be here, but you gave, believing that your giving would build something that was worthy of your investment, that was worthy of your time, that would outlast you, that would become a community institution. So on behalf of all of us at WAMU and American University and NPR, thank you for your support of WGCU. Please keep supporting the station. So thank you. Thank you very, very much.
I'm so glad you remembered to say all that.
Yes. And now, on with the show.
Well, you know, you've just given us a great example of, you know, an interview that was kind of tough at the beginning, but then ended up yielding some great results. I'm wondering if you've done any interviews that, if you had the opportunity, you would have redone them or done something differently.
All of them.
Okay.
Like, because every time I do an interview, I'm on my way home, and my brain's like, you should have asked him. Like, damn it, where were you 2 hours ago? Every interview, they can always be better. Like, this is not a science. This is an art. This is a skill. There's an element of, like, the process. That is, like, the science of making radio. But there's always something I wish I'd asked. Or the script has way more questions in it than we'll ever get to. But then again, that's why we are an interactive show, because you will give us stories and perspectives and questions that are very different from what we would think to ask, because they're reflective of your life and your experience, and they're better than our questions, frankly. They're more useful, they're more pertinent, they're more nuanced than what we can ask, especially if it's something that affects you directly. So there's always days when I walk away like, oh, I wish I'd asked that question. But slowly I let that go. Like, there's no one right way to do an interview. It's like a problem with 1,000 possible solutions, and some are better than others, but, you know, unless an interview just tanks, like really goes badly, at the end of the day, like, show's over, glad it went well, we haven't gotten any calls from the FCC, what's next?
Yeah.
That's the best part of broadcasting.
Exactly.
There's always a new day the next day.
Any messages? No? Yes. Moving on.
So I wanted to ask you a question about how you handle when you are interviewing somebody and they're lying to you. And they're saying things like this, 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 and this, and they're acting as if it's true, and it's demonstrably false. It is not a true thing, and it can be backed up with evidence, whether or not you have the documents actually in your Rolodex head or not. But I've been in those situations, and I hear people say things, and I'm like, that's really not true, but I really don't have the evidence directly in front of me to refute that, although I did a lot of research, but I don't have that exact document popping up in my head. What do you do in those situations?
It depends. I mean, sometimes the things people lie about are illustrative in the same ways the things people get angry about. They kind of reveal character. So sometimes it's valuable to let them continue, because it fleshes out who they are as a character, as a person. Like, what kind of a person would tell X lie? A kind of a person who has Y at stake. So sometimes, and it's case by case, and I don't get it right all the time, but there can be a value from a storytelling perspective, from a narrative perspective, in not going, immediately, in just letting them finish that thought, and then after they're done saying, you know, you said X, that is untrue. Actually, it's Z. Well, no, it's X. No, really. It's not. And at a certain point, I have no problem smacking you in the face live and saying you are not telling the truth, or you are not saying something that is supported by facts. For example, climate change. We are not arguing climate change. Climate change is real. It is caused by human activity. It is demonstrable. It is provable. The science is too solid. And so when a guest comes on and says, well, I'm not really sure about it, I'll say, okay, but there is a scientific consensus, so I really don't care if you're sure. What I want to know is, what do you think the policy is? Well, I think the jury is still out. No, the jury is not out. The scientific consensus around the world is that humans are impacting climate change. Well, it's very important that we have all the facts in. Eventually, I'll be like, look, let me pull over for 1 second. We're moving on because we're not arguing this. You are not going to come on this program and argue whether humans are causing climate change. We are accepting that as a given, and we are moving on because that is my prerogative as the host of the program. We are not arguing climate change. What I asked you was, what do you think we should do about it? And we've had this happen, where someone will say, well, we need a policy that's fiscally prudent and so on. And that's fine. That's perfectly fine if that's their imperative. But the facts, we're not going to argue the facts. That's just not going to happen. We had one guest who, oh gosh, I can't remember who it was. But, it was Phyllis Schlafly's daughter. And stay ahead of me. Don't get ahead of me.
We have smart members.
It was Phyllis Schlafly's daughter. And I asked her something about some of her mother's political advocacy and how she reflected on that. She was ticked. She was like, I do not appreciate, and I'm paraphrasing, you know, I really don't appreciate you slandering my mother that way. I would have expected better from public radio. That is absolutely untrue. I see no reason to answer that question about lies about my mother. And I just stood my ground. And part of me was like, oh my God, I'm going to die if I'm wrong. Because I don't want to slander somebody, and I don't want to be wrong. But I stood my ground, and I said, no, actually, your mother was an advocate for this, this, and this. She said the following things. This is true. No, my mother did not. That is not true. That never happened. I am not okay with you asking that question. And I said, okay, tell you what. Let me ask another question to another guest. We will look this up. And if I am wrong, I will apologize right now. And we moved on to another question, got the information, confirmed that I was correct, and I came back to her and I said, we looked this up, and in the New York Times, on this date, an article by this person said the following. So unless you want to quibble with the Times' reporting, this is true. Now, I understand it's not flattering to you, but it is true. And now you, as her daughter, have chosen to carry on your mother's legacy. This is part of that legacy. How do you answer for it? And I pinned her to the wall. Because if you call me a liar or a slanderer, it is on. And we are getting the facts, and damn it, you better be right. Because if you're wrong, I'm going to make sure the whole country hears the sound of me slapping you with the truth. Because that's our job. NPR, one of its slogans is stand with the facts. I am not going to be nice to you if you play fast and loose with the facts. No. I will always be civil, but I ain't going to be nice if you try to lie to me or my audience on my air. Never. Not ever. We have to stand for what's true. Now, there are certain things that can be edge cases, that can be contextualized, that can be partly true, mostly true, that can be viewed differently. That's all fine. I'm not talking about edge cases, right? I'm talking about facts, like very clear, demonstrable, like one and only one answer kind of things. At a certain point, we have to let people know you can't just walk in and out, because that's a key to civil dialogue, right? You can't have civility if we can't agree on what the facts are. If you have your facts and I have my facts and she has her facts, civil dialogue is impossible. So as a bedrock of everything we do, we have to agree, truth equals truth. Sign here if you agree. We will hold you to this for the next 53 minutes. And then if you want to try to play fast and loose, like, no, you can't disrespect the rest of my guests who done showed up agreeing that they were going to be honest with us and we're going to let you, you know, play outside the boundary lines. No. No. Too late in the day. I don't need those angry tweets. Because you'll hold me responsible, right? You'll get that that person, well, they just like to lie. They have a stake in lying. But you, Mr. NPR host who we trusted, who we spent money to support our local station so they could license your show for the year so you could give us good content, you're the guardian at the gate. And you not only failed the battle, you put your weapon down. Then it's on me. And I'm not having that on me.
That is the new promo for Gulf Coast Live.
Yes.
What?
For our talk show. We're going to use that as our new promo.
Which what? Which,
it's going to be a little long.
We're not having that on us.
Yes.
And we don't need those angry tweets.
Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. We ain't having that on us.
Oh, God.
Lies, We ain't having it.
I hope there's clean audio of that somewhere.
That needs to be like a pledge premium. If you give it the $12 a month level, you get a shirt that says, "Lies, we ain't having it," with like an image of, I'll take the picture of me like.
I can't love it more.
And on the back, WGCU, Southwest Florida, NPR for Southwest Florida. I'm telling you, okay, hold on, I'll do it for you. Oh, ready? Okay, camera's ready? I'm only doing this once. All right, so it's say lies we ain't having. And then you just be like. Everybody got it, my neck is starting to hurt. Is this?
Applause, applause, applause.
There you go.
I love that so much. So we're talking about lies, truth.
Dignity. Public radio is about dignity.
And that pose.
Yes.
And that exact pose. But we're talking
with
about...
a little bit of sass.
All the sass.
Yes.
All the sass. But the thing
this is where it helps to be an out journalist. So people don't look at you like, ah, that... Yes, yes.
Did he just do that?
Duh.
Yeah.
Are you awake? Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. You had something much more useful to say.
I'm going
to
get brainy again and get
yes,
into our broccoli.
Please, exactly.
We're talking about a steady diet of just eat one kind of news and one other kind of news, which is really not so much news. I'm talking about post-fairness doctrine and lack of equal time. That doesn't happen anymore. So then that kind of spawned off opinion kind of like networks that are looking like news, but then they kind of have a very clear set agenda. And I'm wondering, with that kind of a diet available to people, and I know kind of the answer to this already before I ask it, what on that plate of journalism diet, what is A1? Are you like...
1A.
Are you like...
1A.
What did I say?
I said A1, like the
that is the sauce on the plate.
I'm talking about plates. So she
I'm talking about meals
sauce.
And plates, so naturally...
Yeah. I am fired. I'm fired right
it
now.
It requires the savory tang... I get it. It's fine. I know what you meant.
Oh,
be nice to her.
I am now going to crawl over the
Being
back
people.
Of the chair.
No, don't. Please don't. Oh, let's... Hey.
Seriously.
I've said way dumber things to the nation.
Oh,
than
I doubt it.
Believe me.
Oh, I doubt it.
Believe me. But anyway, you
okay, asked. So what I'm saying is the A1 steak sauce on the steak.
Right.
On the diet of journalism. Okay.
See, that's called a save. Uh-huh. That's bridging back. Nicely
thank
done.
You, thank you. Thank you very
Nicely
much.
Done.
Can I have my job back?
Yes.
So the question is, okay, we kind of talk about having to give people the broccoli news, the news that's the broccoli, making people eat their vegetables. So I would think that I would have to describe, I mean, and how would you describe yourself? It's kind of like the veggies with cheese sauce on it, too? Like making things even more palatable, getting people to really think about things, but then also making it something they really want to listen to. That's the challenge.
We did an hour on Spider-Man.
Yes. Well, that's not broccoli.
No, and yet it belongs. Like... We're not the broccoli. We're not something you have so you can get your fiber. Like that's not. We're the steak. Exactly. With the tangy, savory. We are the main course. We're a destination. We want you to go out of your way if you're traveling to find your NPR station, find out when they air 1A, and make a point to listen. We're the centerpiece. We're not something on the side. We want to be central. We won't always be, but that's why we try all kinds of different things. Because this topic may not be, you know, main course material for you today. Maybe it's just a little something you add to your media diet that day. On the other hand, this other topic that you've got a story to tell, you've commented on it, you've shared it online, you told people, oh, that thing we were arguing about the other day, they're going to be talking about it on 1A tomorrow, you got to tune in. Maybe that day we're the main course. We always aim to be your main course, and we aim to prepare it in a way that is not just nutritious, but delicious, that is savory. Elmer Wheeler was one of the great thinkers of sales early in the day, when sales became a business, in like the Mad Men days. And one of his rules of sales was, don't sell the steak, sell the sizzle. Features draw people in, not content. So you find a way to figure out what's appealing, what's savory, what's zesty, what's different, what's pungent, what's aromatic, what is redolent about this story. Not, the nutrition facts on the back of the box. That's bad journalism. Because remember what we said earlier, journalism is a union of news gathering and storytelling. Storytelling part is where you make sure no one views your work as broccoli, ever. If they view your journalism as broccoli, you need a rewrite. So if we want to talk about, you know, tax policy, which is a very cruciferous vegetable, if ever there was one. Tax policy can be super duper dry. Tax returns. Let's go through the rules for the taxes this year. If we were doing something like that on 1A, because the tax code is different this year than it was before, some people are realizing their returns are different than they were, smaller than they were. The government argues it's because more money has been going into your paychecks, less has been deducted, so you've been getting the money up front as opposed to in the refund. So there's a conversation to have there. What does the tax code say? What has the government said? What does this mean for you? If we were doing the call out for this show in our editorial meeting, we might decide, okay, this is a topic we want to do. What's the audience call out going to be today for tomorrow's show? It could be something like, what are your questions about the tax code? But we'll get that live during the show. A call out might be something like, if you were counting on your refund this year, and it's not what you expected, what will you miss? What will you have to do differently? Because your refund is smaller than you thought. Leave us a voicemail. That is where we'd start the show. And then, after we probably mashed up a few stories, maybe one of those, and this happens, we'll have one or two that will be like, this was amazing, and our system records your number, so we might call you back and say, hey, this is, you know, Danielle Knight, I'm a senior producer with 1A, we heard this, you left us a voicemail, do you have a few minutes? Could I record a little bit more with you? Because we really were captivated by your story. And that might be the first 5 minutes of the first segment. The first segment of the show is 12 minutes. Maybe the first five is just somebody's story. And then we get into the details. And the first thing we might ask the guests is, what's your reaction to the story we heard from Deborah in Spokane about, you know, her tax return? And it humanizes that story. Does this make sense? It's the effort that we make to never let this feel academic. Because remember, these are stories that are rooted in real people's lives. And the minute you say, let's talk policy, you pull it away from you, from a real person that you can relate to. Because how many of us can relate to being at a certain period of the year, especially tax time, and being like, oh boy, this is not what I expected. This is going to change the way I pay rent or save for my child's education or, you know, fix the roof or pay our insurance, or, you know, I might have to work this job another year or two. Like, it changes everything. So if it feels like broccoli, that is not on you. That's on us. And one of the things I really love about 1A is we have a team that really loves working with tape, finding good guests, figuring out creative ways to put the show together, chopping the show up. We have actually had to pull back, you know, booking fewer guests instead of more guests, because we're so good at finding people at every single angle of a story. But that's kind of, I think, what helped the show take off. That's why the show caught fire with so many people, is because we kind of hit them out of left field. Like, they didn't expect it to be as moving on some days, or as funny, or as, you know, gripping, or as much of a page-turner as it turned into. I can't take credit for that. That's our team who built this wonderful show. But, you know, it's good storytelling. And NPR is like, I mean, we invented the driveway moment, you know? So let's have some. And we've had a few on 1A. Like, let's strive for those little driveway moments, those little nuggets, because you're not going to remember the whole show. You're going to remember something. You remember some line, you know? And the best stories are the ones where there's plenty for you to kind of, you know, chew on. Like, if I mention Casablanca to you, there's at least one line from that movie that you stick with. You know, be careful, this gun is aimed right at your heart. That is my least vulnerable spot, or something like that. That movie was on in the hotel yesterday. I watched the whole thing. That is one of my favorite movies. One of my five favorite classic movies. We'll talk about that another day. Anyway, we try to give people something to hang on to.
I'm going to let John ask you a question while I slink off the stage in shame. And I'm going to go over and grab the mic. And for the audience, if anybody has any questions, flag me down while they're talking, and I'll get over next to you.
Okay. While she's doing that, your producer had let me know a few minutes before we started here, you're a PlayStation 4 fan.
Yes.
Tell me about what you're playing.
Right now I'm playing a game called Destiny 2. It's a first-person shooter, beautiful, incredible graphics on these like alien worlds where, you know, this alien being has come to Earth that was benevolent and powerful, and then another alien race came to try to steal the power of this being, and you are one of the guardians of the Earth, and you're fighting your way through this incredible open-world landscape. So I'm loving Destiny 2. I played the hell out of Spider-Man, the newish Spider-Man game that came out last year. Love it. Love it! Played it like crazy. I bought all the downloadable add-ons that extended the story. Love it. And I just enjoy it. It's a good break. It's a good release. And we have a few people on our staff who love gaming. One of our producers in particular, Paige Osborne, is a really avid gamer. And we started doing a few shows on gaming. And, you know, come this summer, we're going to put together a whole series of shows on gaming because no one in public radio covers it. There's a lot to discuss. And it's fascinating. It's just one of those things that doesn't really get talked about. We're working on an interview with basically the number one esports player in the country, who is a professional level player. I mean, these are people who play for 10, 12 hours a day for purses that are well into the six figures. And it's just a fascinating world. So it's both journalism and it's my escape from journalism at the same time.
We have a question from the audience. So
yeah, and please do introduce yourself. Just your name, where you're from, if you're here with an organization.
Lee Morris from LaPorte, Indiana.
Hi.
If you were fortunate enough to, or unfortunate enough, to have the opportunity to interview President Trump, what question would you ask him?
Okay, before I answer your question, I hate to answer a question with a question. How many of you were going to ask me the exact same thing? I'm really, ma'am, you beat him up later. I'm really sorry. presuming it was an interview, we'd have time, so I'd ask him a lot of things. Somewhere in the interview, I would just ask him, how much help did the Russians give you win the election? Because everyone who asks the question asks it in a really stupid way. They make it a long question. Like, they say, Mr. President, I'd like to talk to you about the Russia investigation, which immediately makes him go, and he's ready for you. I would sucker punch him with that question. I would ask him between other questions. I would ask him strategically, so how much help did the Russians give you to win the election? And then just let him answer. I would talk to him about the things that he doesn't get asked. I would talk to him about education policy. In the 2016 election, neither major candidate was asked anything about education, and it's vile. It's damnable that we don't talk about education with presidential candidates. I would ask him about trade. For sure I would ask him about trade. I would ask him, why do you watch so much Fox and Friends? I would probably ask it just like that, like, so what's up with you and Fox and Friends? I just want to know, because I don't get it. But I want to. I want to get it. I would ask him as many things as I could with as few lead-ins as I could. One of the best questions he got was at the first press conference he had in March of 2017, I think, when he was introducing Alexander Acosta as the Secretary of Labor. Mara Liasson, NPR correspondent, national political correspondent, asked him, did you fire Mike Flynn, former national security advisor? And he said, I forget exactly what his answer was, but that was the whole question. Did you fire Mike Flynn? Because it was he fired? Did he step down? And so on. She just was like, quick, incisive, simple question. Sometimes asking a question is like drawing blood. Anybody ever had blood drawn at the doctor's office? Anybody ever had blood drawn at the doctor's office by a phlebotomist who never really learned what a vein looks like? And they're rooting around. I just need one more do-over. That's what those long questions are like. I would just like to ask you something about the thing that I'm about to ask you, and what I'm about to ask you is, it's just stupid. Did you fire Mike Flynn? Be incisive with questions. especially important questions. Just get in there, get what you need, and get out. I would do my best to be as surgical as possible in an interview with President Trump, because he hides behind language. So my job would be to keep him as naked as possible, ask super short questions, and keep him bounded in the truth. That would be my goal.
I hope you have that opportunity.
I'd love to. I'd love to.
All right. We have another question back here.
Rick Long from Naples, Florida.
Hi.
Hey. Wanted to ask you about the Clifford Sims interview.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
The author of Team of Vipers. The book about the Trump. Yes.
You got it. And you talked earlier about trauma and the relationship between trauma and anger. I wondered what you saw in that interview. What was really going on there for him?
I thought he was fascinating. I mean, he really did, for as he is still a supporter of President Trump, but he really did seem to have a clear-eyed or more clear-eyed perspective of the moral ambiguities in his presence there. In his book, he writes about being more ideologically aligned with Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and being kind of not very pro-Trump initially, but then as the primary process whittled down, he saw that this candidate was the star to hitch his wagon to. He kind of came around. And so he felt like he had honest moral understandings about, particularly because he was raised Baptist. His father and grandfather were Baptist ministers, so his faith was a big, big part of his life. And so I asked him flat out, like, how does your support of President Trump square with your Christianity? You know, what does the Bible say about your support of him? And he tried to hem and haw, and I just kind of pinned him to the scripture. I said, the Bible says that leaders are to be held to a very high standard. And the president has said and done some things that I think you would agree fall short of that biblical standard. And you worked for him. So how do you square that? And he was clear, like, he didn't know. But he was willing to wrestle with it live. And he didn't try to build too many walls. He built some, and I was like, really? And then the wall came down. So I liked Cliff Sims. He was all right. He was willing to sit in that uncomfortable space, and I appreciated that.
You just answered a different question, too.
Oh.
So that's too.
I'll be a little bit more specific, but I was listening to that same
interview.
Oh,
introduce yourself, please.
Oh, my name is Julie Johnston. I'm
Hi,
from
Julie.
Lakeland, Florida.
Hi.
And I'm here with my mother, who's the former... Oh, okay. Well, anyway. Very proud of her.
She's the former something, but she's still your mom.
Yeah, she's
yes.
still my mom. So,
exactly.
Anyway, when I was listening to that interview and you asked that very pointed question at the time, I thought, why did you... You also shared the fact that you were a Christian, and you don't normally share a lot about your personal. And in that moment, I thought, why did he choose to do this in this moment? I didn't know I was going to meet you and be able to ask that question.
Well, I'm glad you did. First of all, I'm not ashamed to talk about my faith. I have plenty of struggles with my faith, so I'm not like one of those, like an onward Christian soldiers kind of guy. But I found that when it comes to talking about religion, it makes a difference for me as a journalist to ask the question from the perspective of someone who knows scripture. So I'm not speaking as some godless heathen in public radio, because people will just assume that we are all atheists and agnostics, and I was baptized on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday in 1987 for a reason. So I know the Bible. I don't know it cover to cover, but I know enough to ask intelligent questions. I don't speak outside of my knowledge. I'll have BibleGateway.com on my laptop next to me sometimes. But I wanted to make sure he knew I wasn't just doing that kind of like, oh, you Christians, you say one thing and you do another. I wanted to be specific so he could respect the perspective from which the question was coming. I didn't want him to feel... I wanted him to be convicted without feeling condemned. I never want anyone on the show to feel condemned by anything that I say or do, but he put his faith out there. If he hadn't, I wouldn't have, but he did, so I went there.
I'm going in order of who caught the eyeball.
Hi, Doug Bruss from Fort Myers. Two questions. First,
no,
of
you
all,
only get one. You bent my ear off
no,
before
no,
the show.
No.
These people don't know. This man, well, how long was the VIP meet and greet? 45 minutes?
Wait.
He spent 67 minutes. No.
Where can we get a pair of your socks?
Oh, the socks, yes. Did everybody see the... Yeah. These were a pledge premium.
So that's the first the first question.
I will tell you, sidebar, I wore these when I did Meet the Press once, and Chuck Todd looked at him and went, you have 1A socks. He has 1A socks. I said, you should do Meet the Press socks. And he's like, we should do Meet the Pressleys. And you could see his brain. Chuck Todd is cool. Chuck is my friend. Nobody's seen nothing bad about Chuck Todd. I like him. And he's exactly the same on camera as off camera. That is him. But when I did, you could see his brain go. He's like, Meet the Press Sox. So we could put the 70th anniversary logo on it, and you could see his brain, and we were like, 10 minutes to air, Chuck. It was great. Anyway, go ahead.
So as far as when your interview with Terry Gross, who clearly we all respect, I was amazed to hear, I want to get your impression on what she said, about for non-political interviews, she allows the guests to re-record the answer, and she also allows herself to re-record if she doesn't like what she hears. And what about that style? Because that almost shocked me.
Well, yes. She also said that she doesn't extend that to politicians.
Right,
exactly. The other part of that, if you didn't hear it, I interviewed her at a public radio industry conference that was held at WHYY in their amazing, beautiful building. And we asked her about her interview style. And so when they're taping, they're all remote. They're never in the same room. So she's always taping remotely. She says it helps her focus on what they're saying by just not being in the room with them. And so she'll say, you know, we're going to record this interview. It's going to take about this much time. I'll ask you a series of questions. And I say something similar whenever we tape an interview, like if you get stuck or if you trip over your words, just take a breath, pick up where you left off, and we'll edit the mistakes out. But that's more for production. She says something effective like, if you misstate something or you think of a better way to answer the question, just back up and I'll re-ask the question. I understand that in terms of, say, an artist or a person with a personal story to tell, because if their account of their art could be stated more succinctly, they're the expert on their own lives, right? They're the expert on their own art. And I'm cool with that. If it's a politician who's making a position statement or arguing a policy, less mercy for them, and she felt the same way. But in that kind of an interview, you know, sometimes it makes sense. We've done that occasionally, too. Sometimes we'll have an interview and a guest will be like, you know, I thought of a better way to answer that question, and we'll retape it. So we have the original, and we have the revision. It's not like we delete the original and replace it with the revision. We have both. So we can make an editorial decision which one is appropriate to air. Because, again, it's our editorial choice. I'm okay with that as long as it gives us an editorial choice and we're not, like, locked in. Unless they say, okay, what I just told you is I misremembered it. It's totally not true. Please don't use that version. I'm so sorry. Let me give you the correct version. Then it's a huge benefit. We can say, oh, what was wrong about it? Well, I said such and such, and I meant so and so. I'm really, really sorry. No problem. You caught it. Let me re-ask you the question, and we'll put it in the right place. So there's a time when it's editorially appropriate and even preferable.
Hi, my name is Greg Ramshaw. I'm from Bonita Springs.
Hi.
I want to go back to the Phyllis Schlafly's Daughters interview.
Mm-hmm.
When you said you were in pursuit of the truth and during the break you looked it up and you got that from the New York Times. Today she might have said, well, consider the source. I'm not sure that's the truth. Why don't you get it from Fox? How do you respond to that? I mean, I think this is a problem you have in journalism today in determining the truth.
If she had said that to me on the air, I would have probably said something like, come on, stop running. You're running. You're playing games with me. I do not like being played games with. Answer my question. There is a record of your mother saying these things. You are dodging my question. If you can't answer it, say you can't answer it. But my question is legitimate. You say that you are operating in the legacy of your mother. Now, if you want to impugn the New York Times, do it on your own time. I have evidence for my question, and I stand on this evidence. What's your answer? I would have just pinned her to the wall harder. At a certain point, I have to be able to say, no, I'm the host. This is my question. You agreed to be here. Answer the damn question. I don't do it often. I had to do it this week with a guest who was interesting. But if it's necessary, I try to make sure we're on solid ground and then do it. I asked you a factual question. It's a fair question. I can't force you to answer it, but don't piss on my leg and tell me it's raining. Like, don't play this game with me. Just say, I'm not going to answer that. That would be a much more legitimate answer. I'm not answering that question. Fine, whatever, and we move on. But to try to like duck and dodge and make me seem like I'm the bad guy because I didn't give you a fact from somebody you were friends with, get out of my face with that foolishness. No, I asked you a fair question.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm a journalism student here.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yay.
Do you have any advice for aspiring journalists who really admire you?
Well, that's very kind of you. What kind of work, what year are you?
I'm a junior.
Okay. Do you know what kind of work you want to do when you graduate?
I'd like to be a food writer, but awesome. I mean, anything. I mean, any general advice.
If I gave you $10,000 that you had to spend in the next month to do something you love, how would you spend the money?
I would travel. I've never been outside the country.
Where would you go?
I don't know.
Where would you go? You got to spend this money in a month.
I would go to India.
What would you see in India?
Just the people, just how they act.
Where in India?
Lives.
You know there's like more people in India than Fort Myers. So where
that.
Would you go?
Probably Bombay.
What would you see in Bombay? What would you want to come back from Bombay with?
Just the experience of a different culture.
Something. What about the different culture? Be specific. You got $10,000. Now, money's not the object. What would you want to get out of that? First thing I would suggest you do is figure out what you really want. Because if you're good, and if you pound the pavement and hone your craft and pay your dues, one day you will get your chance. Do not throw away your shot, because that door doesn't open every day. The first thing you need to do is know what you want. What you want. Not what you'll accept. You might have to accept jobs along the way. Everyone does that. I did it. Everyone does it. But what do you want? There's no map to where you're going. But you should at least have a compass. You should know what your true north is as a journalist. And how you get there will materialize. But if I was hiring anybody, and I'm not a manager on our show, I don't have hiring and firing power, but if I did, that would be a question I would ask every single person who comes to work for 1A. If we gave you $10,000 in a month to come back with show ideas, where would you go and what would you bring back? We want to see how big your ambition is. We want to see how well you plan. We want to see if you understand what it takes to get from ideation to execution. We want to see if you know what kind of deliverables can be acquired on certain kinds of reports. Like, we want to see where your head is at. That's the first thing I would suggest, is to know what you want and define it down to a fare-thee-well. Like, write it in detail and know it. So that if anyone who wants to hire you says, so where do you see yourself in 5 years? You got the answer. The other thing I would suggest is whatever it is you want to do, and I don't know, are you mostly like print or television or print? Do you have a blog or are you writing or? Okay. Do you do any kind of, you say you like food journalism. Are you doing food writing now or? Okay. Seth Godin, who is a marketing guru, has a rule. It's not art until you, it doesn't exist until you publish it. Simon Sinek says it's not art unless you share it. If you don't publish it, your journalism is literally worthless. You have no value if you don't share what you create. So when you graduate, you need to have a portfolio of food journalism. You need to have some pictures you've taken around Fort Myers, or, you know, go to Naples, go up to St. Pete, like, go somewhere and start telling stories or put a podcast together. Doesn't matter if it's bad. You know, what was it that, was it Ernest Hemingway who said, you know, you got to write out the 10,000 bad versions until you get to the one good one? You have to start writing out your bad work, because let me assure you, you have some terrible journalism in you. Oh my God! Some of your work is gonna suck in ways that will shock you. But if you don't start building your craft now, you're gonna start building it on the job with an employer. Don't wait. You need to graduate ready. Give yourself a rolling start as a journalist. Because if you don't, someone else will. And the journalist who graduates school with a rolling start is going to beat you for the job every time. Talent will never beat skill. Build your skill now and build it in the direction of where you would spend that $10,000. If you haven't started, you're late. That's my advice.
We have time for
for a couple more questions. We have just a few more.
And I'll try to make these quick so we can get more in. Hi.
Sorry, I'll ask quick. My name is Michael. I'm an instructor here at FGCU.
Hi.
Hi. Basically, my question for you, first of all, thank you for being here.
Sure.
And thank you for everything that you're doing. Basically, my question is a format question. I noticed when you took over for Diane Reen that you kind of got away from the call-in aspect of the show, and you do more of the, you know, answering Twitter questions, answering voicemails, stuff like that. I was wondering why you kind of made that transition.
That was not entirely, I mean, that was something that our executive producer, Rupert Allman, built into the structure of the show. It was a way that we could allow the audience to kind of co-author the show with us more. As I mentioned, sometimes we'll get voicemails that'll pull the show in a different direction. And it just allowed it to be, it gave us more flexibility in how we build the show. We will take live calls if we feel that the topic of the show lends itself to live calls. Movie Club, we do live calls. After the Las Vegas mass shooting, we did live calls because we literally didn't know what the hell to say about it. And we were like, I bet everybody else in the country just needs to like get this out of their system. So we just did like a national check-in hour. And it was moving and it was worthwhile and it was powerful. So we did it to make it less of the furniture of the show and more of an editorial element that we would have a little more agency over.
I wondered if you had any, Elaine from Fort Myers.
Hi.
If you had any information on who listens, demographics, you know, what groups are you reaching?
That is probably a better question. Where's Rupert? That's probably a better question for Rupert. Rupert Allman, our executive producer. I'm trying to reach everybody, but he knows who we're actually hitting.
Everybody listens.
There you go.
We do have, the audience has changed since Diane. It has grown, the stations have grown. And it depends a little bit of where the audience is. So by and large, the people who listen in real time has been pretty stable. But we've grown an audience who engage with the program on their phones. And overwhelmingly, they tend to be under the age of 35. So it's a mix because we're hitting people all over the time. And I was saying in the lunch a bit earlier, really, there are plenty of people who only know Joshua because he's a podcast host. They don't actually know that he does a live show. So it depends a little bit about where people are accessing this.
Yeah. Any more that we can get in? We'll squeeze in one or two more. I know we got to go soon.
Hi, I'm Susan Herbel from Fort Myers, but I was born and raised in Kansas.
Hi.
And I wanted to, first of all, I didn't think anybody could ever replace Diane Reem, and congratulations.
Oh, I'm just her successor. No one replaces
you,
Diane.
You never, but you...
I cannot fill Diane's shoes. They're size 9 and really pointy. I can't, but thank you.
Well, the show never missed a beat,
well, thank
which
you.
Was a surprise and a welcome. Anyway, as I said, I was born and raised in Kansas, 90 miles northwest of Wichita. Mm-hmm. We always thought, most of us who grew up in Kansas, thought that our famous duo in Wichita, Kansas, you may have heard of them. Anyway, I wanted to compliment you on the way you handled Alec in that episode. That was very, very tough.
Oh, American Legislative Exchange Council, yes.
Yeah, and it was, I thought it was amazing that you were so neutral on the air through the whole show, but in my opinion, you really skewered Alec, which needs to be skewered. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I thank you? No, thank you. When you said Alec, my brain was like, Baldwin? No. Thank you for that. I will say with regards to my neutrality, I've come to think, because we talk a lot about objectivity in journalism and, oh, can journalists be objective? I have come to worry less about being objective as a journalist and more about being clinical as a journalist. And what I mean is, you know, if you're a cancer researcher, your goal is to cure cancer. But as an oncologist, I can't go in there and kill every sample I have. I have to take the sample as it is, study the hell out of it, and learn as much as I can about squamous cell carcinomas or whatever as they are. I have to do pure bench research so that cures can be found. And if I contaminate my sample, my data is useless. Same thing with me as an interviewer. Before I go in the studio, which is my lab, I have to wash my hands thoroughly. And I'm trying to wash off my biases, my preconceptions, my prejudices, my stereotypes, and just take the sample I have. I'm not objective on racism, But I can have a clinical conversation, for example, with someone who venerates Confederate statues and ask, you know, what do you feel when you see one of these statues? What did you think when the statue came down? Do you understand why it is that these have fallen out of favor? I'm not objective on sexism. I am not objective on sexism. But I can't have a clinical conversation with a man who's rethinking his interactions with women. Where are some of the touch points where it gets difficult? How did you learn, as a younger man, how men and women are supposed to interact? Things like that. And if I contaminate my sample with my biases, the data I give you is useless to advancing whatever it is we're trying to do as a society. Does that make sense? So for me, it gives me permission to be a real person. And when I leave the lab, all the stuff I scrubbed off is going to jump right back on me. Because that's the nature of it. So it gives me permission to be a real person, and it also creates a framework within which it doesn't have to be about me, and the focus can be on just providing good information from the sample, from the story, from the guests that I've been given, and it makes my work much, not easier, it makes it more productive to just go in very clinically.
Do we have time for one more question?
Sure.
One last one.
Make it good.
You are on my bucket list to see live, so first of all, thank you.
Oh, for goodness sake, thank you.
And second, who would you like to interview?
Who would I like to? Oh, gosh. I'd like to interview a lot of people. I think we're going to have time for one more question, because that's an easy one. I would like to interview, well, my former top would have been Michelle Obama's mother. Because I think that I wanted to know how you turned Michelle Obama into Michelle Obama, but Gail King got the interview first, so if anyone knows Gail, just let her know she's dead to me. But, you know, I will say, you know, the people, and I enjoy interviewing celebrities. You know, we have a long list of people we'd like to get, and, you know, we want to interview the presidential candidates that are coming up, and there's all kinds of celebrities and so on. But really, what makes one a pop for us is not the interviews with famous people. It's the interviews with people who've got a story to tell, you know? It's the ones that kind of come out of left field that are just people kind of like you whose lives aren't that extraordinary, maybe in and of themselves, but once they tell you about them, they're wonderful. I know we got to go. We were visiting New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, and we did a show about, you know, New Hampshire trying to retain young people for the jobs that are there. There are lots of jobs, but not a lot of young people to fill them. And one of the guests we had on runs an organization that trains young adults in skilled trades like construction work and that kind of thing. We only had him on for the first segment. Last question I asked him was, you know, I know a lot of young people don't really think about construction as a career. If you could explain to them what it is you get out of being a construction worker, out of building buildings, what would you say? And he said something to the effect of, whenever I drive through downtown Boston, I can look at the Prudential Tower, I can look at this bridge, I can look at that building and say, I built that. And I know where every rivet was, I know every steel girder. It's like artwork, but the skyline is your canvas. And when I drive through a city, I can know that I've built something useful and beautiful. Because that was my canvas. That's what I get out of construction. I know, right? Now, do I want to spend my time chasing those interviews that Gail King's going to get anyway? Just because I'm not Oprah's friend. Not that I'm bitter. Or do I want to see the celebrity in everybody? Do I want to see the story in everybody? That's the power of NPR. That's why StoryCorps is so powerful, right? Because everybody's got something. Everybody's got a story to tell. And they're not all going to be your Friday morning tearjerker, but there's something wonderful in just letting people open their heart to you. This guy's a construction worker. I've never viewed construction workers the same since he told me that story. I have so much more I'm like, that is what you do, isn't it? Like, we couldn't, wow, yes, that is exactly what you do. I will never look at a skyline anywhere the same after hearing him say, I'm an artist and the skyline is my canvas. Wow. And that's what I want. That's the interview I want to land. I want to land the interview with a person who has such a great story to tell that if we don't tell it, it'll never get told. That's the work of 1A. That's the work of WGCU and stations across the country, is to try to find these stories and not only get them, but tell them in a way that hooks you, that makes you want to hear the whole thing, and that makes you want to know when it's over, is that it? Where can I find the link? How can I share that out? How can I contact that guy? I want to ask him more questions. That's the sweet spot. And it makes for a very different kind of show for us. We're not jockeying with everybody for all the big guests. We do for some of them. Some we get, some we don't. But on those days when we can elevate a person who... There's that line in the movie, The Imitation Game, that says, it's the people who no one thinks anyone of who do the things nobody could think of. That's the goal. It's to be able to reflect you back to yourself and everyday people just like you, but not just to see the ordinary, but to see the extraordinary. And maybe if we show you the extraordinary in someone else, you'll see it in yourself. And if you see it in yourself, the next time you're having that conversation across the dinner table with that uncle, that uncle, maybe you'll see his 20-ton shield. Maybe you'll see his ordinary eye, his extraordinary eye for ordinary things. Maybe you'll see him not for the anger, but for the pain. Not for the obvious, but for the underlying. Maybe you'll model what you've seen us do. 1A only works if I'm not the only interviewer. It can't just be me. It has to be you. And if you can find the celebrity in someone else and make room for them to be the star of their own story, then that's enough for me. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate you coming, and please keep supporting WGCU. Thanks, everyone.
That's all the time we've got. If you missed part of today's show, tune in tonight at 9 o'clock after the TED Radio Hour to hear the re-air. Or you can hear this panel discussion with Joshua Johnson in its entirety, including questions from the studio audience, on our website, gulfcoastlive.org. Or you can subscribe to the Gulf Coast Live podcast on iTunes, NPR One, or wherever you get your podcasts. Speaking of podcasts, we produce a podcast here at WGCU called Three Song Stories. And last week, while he was here, Mr. Johnson sat in our studio with Mike Kanairy for the Gulf Coast Live Hour to record his reflections on three songs that helped tell the story of his life. You can also find that online at gulfcoastlive.org or soon on threesongstories.org. Our show today was produced by Mike Kanairy and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM. NPR for Southwest Florida.